Have you ever had a day that just started out great? You wake up, you get to eat your favorite breakfast, drink your favorite drink, whether it be coffee, hot chocolate, or orange juice. You just feel refreshed. You then begin your day with a great spirit, excited to face whatever is going to face you that day. And out of nowhere, someone says something that just ruins your day. Maybe you spill your coffee all over you. Maybe the food you ate actually wasn't that good and now you have a stomach ache. And now your day is just off. You think, man, I can't wait for this day to be over because it feels like it just keeps getting worse and worse. This kind of thing happened to me back in college. Life was going great. I was making friends. I was doing well on the track team. Grades were fine. Then one night, I think it was 1 a.m., I get a call from my dad saying, hey, granddad just passed away unexpectedly. I'm sitting there like, what in the world? Why would God take granddad from me? So I wake up the next day and I realize, man, I don't have any friends here. All these friends are superficial. And I just feel alone. I remember walking to one of my classes and just weeping because no one cared about my granddad, about me, about anything. So I continued on and my grades began to decline. You know, track was whatever at that point. I just was like, I don't like this. I hate my life right now. And it wasn't until I turned to my Bible, I turned to Scripture, and I started reading about what Christ has done for me. And then I turned to my local church, which was all the way back in Maryland at the time. I was in Indiana. And I was encouraged by my pastor back then, back there. And I was reminded that no matter what happens in this life, Christ is faithful. And Christ died on the cross. He rose again and ascended into heaven for me and for anyone who repents of their sins and turns to Christ. When tragedy hits you hard, what are you going to hold fast to? Are you going to hold fast to yourself and the things around you? Or are you going to hold fast to God, who keeps his promises and is always near and never far? Our main text today is Exodus chapter 1, verses 1 through 22. And here we're going to see that Yahweh, God, keeps his covenantal promises with his people. Yahweh keeps his covenantal promises with his people. Moses in this passage reveals this to us by showing us in verses 1 through 7 God's people flourishing as a result of their faith in the biblical mandate given back in Genesis 1:28. Second, Moses explains how the seed of the serpent seeks to reverse the efforts of the seed of the woman, which we see enacted back in Genesis 3:15. And lastly, in verses 15 through 22, Moses explains how the seed of the serpent, and the seed of the serpent is anyone who is against God, in case you don't understand that reference. So Moses explains how the seed of the serpent seeks to swallow up the seed of the woman. Okay? And the seed of the woman is, in the end, Jesus. Okay? So as we settle into this Old Testament epic, we need to make sure we're all on the same page when it comes to what Exodus is about, how Exodus contributes to the rest of the Bible, and how the themes in Exodus are developments of Genesis and developed further in the rest of the Bible. So before we even look at our text today, let me briefly explain to you and give you a little tour of the Pentateuch. The Pentateuch is the first five books of the Bible, otherwise known as the Torah, or just the first five books of the Bible, whatever's easiest for you to remember. But these five books are written by one author. That author is Moses. That's important. So it shouldn't be a surprise to us when we see themes and words and ideas in Exodus that we've also seen in Genesis, that we might see in Numbers, in Leviticus, in Deuteronomy. Okay? So, 'cause all of these themes and ideas and words are from one author. So it might be helpful, too, to kind of see how these books are in relationship with one another. I don't know if you can see this because of the glare, but if you can, that's okay. But think of this as a pyramid that's on its side. Okay, a pyramid has founding blocks on the very far side of it. Okay, Genesis and Deuteronomy are those founding blocks. Okay? Genesis acts as the prologue. Deuteronomy acts as the epilogue. And in these two books, you see God setting apart a nation. And then he blesses them with land, seed, and blessing. And then as you build upon this pyramid, you have these middle blocks before you get to the peak. And these middle blocks here is Exodus and Numbers. Both of these books mirror one another. They're very similar. The people that God chose in Genesis and Deuteronomy are now in the wilderness. They're seeking God in the wilderness. And this is their journey, okay? All through Numbers and all through Exodus. And then these books have their climax, have their point in Leviticus. Okay, so the top of the pyramid is Leviticus. And the reason Leviticus is the climax to this story is because this is where God reveals he has made a way for his people to have relationship with him. This is so important. Okay, the book of Leviticus reveals that us sinners can have a relationship with a holy God. Okay, so another way of saying this, Genesis prologue, Deuteronomy epilogue, we move inward, Exodus, they leave Egypt, and then they build their tabernacle. Numbers, they dedicate the tabernacle, and they're preparing to leave to go to Canaan. And then Leviticus is the tabernacle service, how we have relationship with God. So in these structures, one can see how Exodus is pointing to Leviticus and is a part of a greater story. So it should not be read in isolation and shouldn't be excluded from the rest of the Pentateuch. One of Exodus's primary themes is Yahweh creating a way for the people of God to dwell in the divine presence. This theme is first seen in Genesis 1 through 3, where God, he creates a perfect world and he creates Adam and Eve in this perfect world. But fairly quickly, what do Adam and Eve do? They turn away. They sin. And God has to react. And so he reacts by removing them from his perfect presence. But we know he doesn't just remove them and cast them aside. There's a promise in Genesis 3:15 of a coming Messiah who will conquer the seed of the serpent. So Exodus furthers this story by separating a people for God and then giving the people a tabernacle to meet God in, and for God to dwell among his people. Thus, what is Exodus primarily about? Exodus is primarily concerned with how God takes the initiative to make himself known and be known by his people. Okay, Exodus is primarily about how God takes the initiative to make himself known and be known by his people. And we can see this quite simply, the very beginning of Exodus, chapter 3, verse 2, where God appears to Moses in the burning bush and calls and sets aside Moses. And then we see this at the very end of Exodus, in Exodus 40, where God descends in to the tabernacle that Israel just made for him. And then we can see it all throughout the middle of the book, where he's dwelling with his people, whether it be in the pillar of fire or the cloud or many other ways. God is initiating all things that we see in Exodus and with his people. So another quick kind of overview of Exodus. We're going to be in three primary locations whenever we're in the book of Exodus. Exodus chapter 1 all the way to 13 is Israel dwelling in Egypt. Okay? This is really easy for us when we're reading Exodus. If you're in chapters 1 all the way to 13, where are you at? Israel's in Exodus. Okay, chapters 14 through 18, where's Israel at? They're wandering in the desert on their way to Mount Sinai. So that's 14 through 18. Then lastly, 19 through 40, where's Israel at? They're dwelling at Mount Sinai. So you're either dwelling in Egypt on the way to Sinai or you're at Sinai. Three major locations in the book of Exodus. in all of these locations serve to further the theme of God dwelling in the midst of his people. Okay, so that's a really quick overview of Exodus and kind of how it plays its part in the greater five books of the Old Testament. Okay, and we're going to see today that these themes even further show themselves in the rest of the Bible. But let's look at these opening verses, chapter 1 of Exodus, verses 1 through 5, where we see a picture of God's people flourishing. This is what the text says, verse 1. These are the names of the sons of Israel, who came to Egypt with Jacob, each with his household: Reuben, Simeon, Levi, Judah, Issachar, Zebulun, and Benjamin, Dan, Naphtali, Gad, and Asher. All the descendants of Jacob were 70 persons. Joseph was already in Egypt. Then Joseph died, and all his brothers, and all that generation. But the people of Israel were fruitful and increased greatly. They multiplied, and they grew exceedingly strong, so that the land was filled with them. So this book opens up with a genealogy that was actually first seen in Genesis 46:8. Here, Moses explains who is entering into Egypt to join Joseph. The sons of Jacob are, as a result of a 7-year famine that had come upon the land, which Moses assumes we know. So this is interesting, okay? If we think of the author of all these books is Moses, he's assuming a lot right now. He's assuming his audience knows how and why Jacob's family is migrating from Canaan to Egypt. He assumes his audience knows that Jacob and Israel aren't two different people, but the same person who was Jacob at one point, and then now he is Israel. He assumes we know why Joseph's in Israel, and he also assumes we know that Joseph is Jacob's sons. With these assumptions, Moses is showing us that God keeps his covenant. The promise he gave to Abraham back in Genesis 12:2 has not gone away. God's people are still filling the land. Moses is also showing us that God truly is going to bless the world through the descendants of Jacob, and which he first promised Abraham back in Genesis 12:2-3. So this genealogy here is here to serve us as an explanation that God is preserving his people. Genealogies often just get skipped over. But Moses is saying, hey, God's fulfilling his promise he gave to Abraham. The people of God are filling the land, and they're multiplying, just like he commanded them to do. Look down at verse 5. It says, all the descendants of Jacob were 70 persons. Joseph was already in Egypt. So this phrase, all the descendants of Jacob, which actually, if you, it can be rendered a little bit differently. The NASB says, all the persons who came from the loins of Jacob. This phrase, actually, the word loins or descendants here, actually refers to the hip. It's a Hebrew word for yarek, which might seem like, oh, who cares? Why is it the Hebrew? Like, that doesn't matter. But it does matter, because the word hip should bring something to mind. What happens to Jacob's hip? It gets dislocated because he's wrestling with God, or with, sorry, an angel of the Lord. Why is he wrestling with an angel of the Lord? Because he wants to receive his blessing. And he does. And this is the result of his blessing. People spreading throughout the land. So it's not just the descendants of Jacob. It's those from the hip of Jacob. So again, Moses is linking Exodus with Genesis to show that God is actively involved in his people's lives. 6 and 7, verses 6 and 7, show us even more of this. So notice, right after explaining all these people entering Egypt, he then, so 70 descendants and more, and they're flourishing. And then what happens in verse 6? Joseph dies. All of his brothers die. all that generation die. What just happened? I mean, we know from Genesis 50 that Joseph dies of old age. Like, that's obvious. But why open the book with a genealogy and then all of a sudden say, hey, all these people are dead? Moses is pointing out that God, even though people die, even though this man who led all these people into Egypt died, God will continue to be faithful. Look at verse 7. But the people of Israel were fruitful and increased greatly. It's not due to Joseph that they're fruitful and increasing greatly. It's due to God. They multiplied and grew exceedingly strong so that the land was filled with them. The sons of Israel were fulfilling their biblical mandate given back in Genesis 1:28 to be fruitful and multiply. Thus, verse 7 shows us what happens when we seek after God and obey Him as a result of a changed heart. He causes His people to flourish. The literal translation of verse 7 says something like this. As for the Israelites, they grew, they were fruitful, they swarmed, they increased, they got more powerful and more, and the land was filled with them. This whole verse should flood your mind with creation imagery. Swarmed and flourishing and filling the land and increasing. And it should cause you to ask the question, why are they growing so quickly? This is kind of weird. It's because they are living in light of God's commands. They are living by faith. They know what God said in Genesis 1:28 and then restated to Noah in Genesis 9:1. They know the account of Babel. What did they do? They didn't fruitful and multiply. They stayed in one spot and built a big tower. They also know the promises given to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob concerning how God will cause them to grow and have his descendants that number more than the sand on the seashore. What is happening here is actually spectacular. God is causing the Israelites to flourish because they are trusting in his promises and the promises that he gave to their forefathers. Though Joseph, their forefather, led them into Egypt, is now dead, they continue to look forward to the coming Messiah. Thus, God is a God who preserves his people no matter what. So these opening pages kind of remind me of a really bad Star Wars movie called Rogue One. In this movie, you have these rebels. They're like going crazy and trying to destroy the Emperor. And they take trying to steal the plans of the Death Star. In this story, you kind of grow attached to these people. You start to develop a fondness for them. And you might even think, these are the people who are going to defeat the Emperor. And they're going to defeat Darth Vader. But as you watch the movie, you realize, oh, they help, but they don't actually defeat the enemy. It's not until Luke Skywalker comes who defeats the enemy. They had to look to someone in the future to continue on what they started. Moses wants to remind his readers that there is one who is coming, whose life will have no end, and lead his people into paradise. And we know who that person is. That person is Jesus Christ. So these people were flourishing because they set their hope in the promises of God. Ask yourself, what are you looking to for hope? Do you find yourself in despair, waiting for God to do a miracle in your life? Are you looking for someone to just fill you up, that you can trust, that you can rely on, who will never let you down? The Israelites understood. They needed to place their faith in a never-changing promise of God, that he would cause them to flourish and that he would redeem them through the seed of the woman. Don't place your hope in the things of this world. Church, place your hope in Jesus Christ, who is the Messiah who came and who has come and who is living and active in our lives. Don't wait for someone else. Jesus has come and ascended to the throne, and he crushed the seed of the serpent. Place your hope in him and nothing of this world. Look what happens next. We're going to transition into verses 8 through 14, and we're going to see the seed of the serpent reversing the things that the seed of the woman are supposed to be doing. So, this is important for us to know. Okay, we know that Christ has conquered, but the Israelites don't know that. Okay, Israelites don't know about Jesus, but they're placing their faith in God who keeps his promises. Look at verses 8 through 14. Now there arose a new king over Egypt who did not know Joseph, and he said to his people, "Behold, the people of Israel are too many and too mighty for us. Come, let us dwell or deal shrewdly with them, lest they multiply, and if war breaks out, they join our enemies and fight against us and escape from the land." Therefore they set taskmasters over them to afflict them with heavy burdens. They built for Pharaoh cities of Pithom and Ramses. But the more they were oppressed, the more they multiplied, and the more they spread abroad. And the Egyptians were in dread of the people of Israel. So they ruthlessly made the people of Israel work as slaves, and made their lives bitter with hard service in mortar and brick, and in all kinds of work in the field. In their work, they ruthlessly made them work as slaves. So here the narrative shifts a little. The Israelites are in Egypt. They are being fruitful and they're multiplying. Then verse 8 comes out of nowhere and says, "Now there arose a new king over Egypt who did not know Joseph." And how does he respond to Israel growing? Well, he sees that they are mighty, and he tells his people to deal shrewdly with the Israelites, telling them that they will overtake them, they will take his kingdom, and if enemies attack, they'll unite with the enemies, and then they'll flee the land. Verse 8 tells us that the king did not know Joseph. Now, I don't think this means that he didn't know about or who Joseph was. Rather, I think Moses is stating this king did not honor the arrangements Joseph set up with the previous kings of Egypt. Thus, this king of Egypt, not knowing Joseph, seems to have been his way of saying, "I don't care who Joseph was. I don't care that Joseph saved us because he knew about the famine and he knew about the land of plentiful or the time of plenty. I don't care what he's done. I'm the new king. And I actually want to set myself above him and above the things that he's put in order because I'm a better king." This word arose in verse 8, it says there arose a new king, could indicate that this isn't just a single king that arose, but a brand new dynasty. Typically, when a dynasty happens, there establishes new policies and new laws. So it kind of makes sense that this dynasty arises and says, whatever Joseph put into place, I don't care about. I want to be better and known as a wiser king than Joseph was. But notice, Moses portrays this king with some insecurities. Look at 9 and 10. "And he said to his people, 'Behold, the people of Israel are too many and too mighty for us. Come, let us deal shrewdly with them, lest they multiply. And if war breaks out, they join our enemies and fight against us and escape the land.'" That sounds kind of weird. He creates a false narrative in his head, and he acts on that false narrative. And he acts with no justification. Instead of working with the Israelites, he, out of fear and imagination, sets himself against them by setting up taskmasters, which we see in 11 through 14. These taskmasters demand for the Israelites to labor rigorously and hard. He made the Israelites' lives bitter with hard labor by making them build bricks and mortar and giving them various kinds of labors in the field and imposing all kinds of work on them rigorously. Should be noticed that Moses uses the same language to describe the material the king makes Israel use, so that's brick and mortar, that the people of the Tower of Babel used back in Genesis 11, where they use brick and mortar. So Moses is clearly establishing Pharaoh with the wicked builders who oppose fruitful, multiplying, who oppose the people of God. This king is establishing his own kingdom, not the kingdom of God. And a ruler not established by God and hates God is dangerous, because the fear of man causes us to assume and then act rashly. Okay, but why the hard labor? Like, what's that going to accomplish? Well, if you think about it, being under hard labor, being away from your wife daily for long periods of time and being exhausted with hard labor, you're not going to want to come home and procreate, probably. Okay? And then if you're laboring on someone else's fields, what's happening to your fields? They're dying. They're not getting taken care of. And then if you're laboring long hours, what happens to your health? So you're working hard for the king. You got to come home, do your own fields. Then you got to take care of your family. Well, you're not getting sleep. So you're probably going to get sick. Pharaoh's a crafty man. He knew what he was doing. He said, I'm going to make you work hard. I'm going to make you work extra hard. I'm going to make you work even more hard so that you can't procreate. Pharaoh's plan was crafty. And he sought to reduce the growth of Israel, of the Israelites. But what actually happened? Well, look at verse 12. But the more they were oppressed, the more they multiplied and they spread abroad throughout the land. So Israel grew in number and in locations. They thrived in the persecution. That's not to say they enjoyed it. Please don't hear me say that. But it is to say that God preserved them and caused them to grow even more. Again, fulfilling that promise back in Genesis 12. So how does Pharaoh react to this? They're still growing. Well, 13 and 14 actually shows that he acts even more harshly on them. So if you want to look, you can look at your version. I wanted to emphasize this word service. So 13 and 14, it's going to look a little different. This is what it says. They ruthlessly made the people of Israel work with service and made their lives bitter with hard service in mortar and brick and with all kinds of service in the fields and with all kinds of service. They ruthlessly made them work with service. The way I think about this account, it's kind of like my backyard. So a month ago or so, I saw some dandelions growing and I thought, man, I'm going to destroy those things before they start to grow. So what do? I don't talk to anybody. I don't go to the plant people and say, how do you get rid of dandelions? I grab my stupid lawnmower and go whoosh, right over them. And I'm like, they're dead. I got this. What happens the next day? There's 20,000 of them in my backyard, okay? I'm not lying. The next day, they were everywhere. So what do? I'm like, dude, I'm going to get some pesticide. I'm killing this stuff. So I spray my lawn like crazy. And they keep growing. The more labor I put on these stinking plants, the more they grow. So now I get like this concentrated weed killer and I'm just dumping like gallons of it on these things. Like now they're going to die. They're still not dead. No matter how hard I worked to attack these dandelions, they kept growing. Because I was stupid and selfish and thought all about myself and didn't actually talk to the people who might know a little bit more about how you actually kill dandelions. It's not by cutting them, that's for sure. They spread like wildfire. Pharaoh did the same. He let fear, anger, and insecurities drive him against God's people, when he should have actually just turned to them and maybe made a mutually beneficial arrangement with the Israelites. Or if he would have known his history, he would have gone, I think I remember something about this Abraham guy and God blessing him. And then God saying, those who bless you, I will bless. And those who curse them, I will curse. Maybe I should just actually help them out. Because actually, you know, I may not believe in this God, but it seems like whoever curses them will be cursed and whoever blesses them will be blessed. But instead, he acts on his fear. And as a result, he gets actually oppressed himself by the people growing. They're not even doing anything. They're just living out the biblical mandate. And now Pharaoh's scared and living in fear. So I think what we can take away from this section is that God's people are called to live faithfully, even when we're persecuted. There's no indication in this text that Israel was happy and enjoying life. There's actually the opposite. But what we can see here is that they were living in the promises of God, despite their life circumstances. Notice, despite all that the seed of the serpent Pharaoh tried, he actually caused their eventual departure. So in verse 10, it says, I don't want them to leave. But what happens if we know the book of Exodus? We know that they actually leave the land due to Pharaoh. So think about, though the seed of the serpent may come to upend all of God's purposes, and life may seem bleak and void, we can trust God, who uses all of life to shape us and to mold us for his purposes and for his glory. The purposes of God always outweigh the schemes of man. So we've seen so far, verses 1 through 7, people of God flourishing because they're living out in faith the biblical mandate given in Genesis 1 through 12. And then we've seen the seed of the serpent, Pharaoh, try to reverse these things, try to stop them from flourishing. Now, lastly, in 15 through 20, we're going to see how this man, Pharaoh, the seed of the serpent, tries to swallow up the Israelites through killing their baby boys. Look at 15 through 22 with me. Then the king of Egypt said to the Hebrew midwives, one of whom was named Sephora and the other Puah, when you serve as midwives to the Hebrew women and see them on the birth stool, if it is a son, you shall kill him. But if it is a daughter, she shall live. But the midwives feared God and did not do as the king of Egypt commanded them, but let the male children live. So the king of Egypt called the midwives and said to them, why have you done this? And let the male children live. The midwives said to Pharaoh, because the Hebrew women are not like the Egyptian women, for they are vigorous and give birth before the midwives come to them. So God dealt with the midwives, and the people multiplied and grew very strong. And because the midwives feared God, he gave them families. Then Pharaoh commanded all his people, every son that is born to the Hebrews, you shall cast into the Nile, but you shall let every daughter live. So moving forward in this chapter, we see Pharaoh continuing his devastating plan to ruin the lives of the Israelites by now meeting with midwives of the Israelites and telling them to kill all of the sons that the Hebrew women bear. So, but the midwives, what do? They disregard this and they say, we're going to let them live. And then Pharaoh reacts in rage. And then God protects the midwives. And then Pharaoh tells all of the Egyptians to kill all of the Hebrew sons by throwing them into the Nile. So it's obvious Pharaoh is desperate. He thinks, how do I stop the growth of these people? Well, I'm just going to start killing all their sons. And in verse 15, the story shifts off Pharaoh for a second and onto Sephora and Puah, who barely anything is known about. But we do know that they're the Hebrew midwives. So it seems plausible that they were maybe the head midwives in charge of all these other midwives, or that they maybe only got called when things were bleak with a Hebrew midwife or a Hebrew mom giving birth. We don't know what their overall role is here, but we do know that they were meeting with most women giving birth to children. But either way, it's helpful to know that these women took a stand and did not follow the heinous command of Pharaoh. Why? Why did they disregard this powerful ruler? Look at verse 17. But the midwives feared God. They feared God. The fear that they are experiencing here is not a terror where they crumble away and they wither away and say, oh, I'm afraid of God. But rather, it's a respectful fear. We saw this in Abraham when he feared God by offering Isaac up to God, by putting the sword or knife in his hand and almost plunging it into his son. He feared God. He respected God so much so that he would do whatever God commanded him. These women fear God more than they fear Pharaoh. And that's important for us to know. This question, or this should make you ask, where do my loyalties lie? Who do I fear more, man or God? These women knew God. These women were brave and have a place forever in the Word of God. They stayed the hand of Pharaoh. What a testimony to us. We should find hope in this story. God preserves them. He gives them, and here it says families. In another translation, it says houses. Even though Pharaoh was angry with them and probably wrathful towards them, God preserved these Hebrew midwives. So, another question arises. Did they lie to Pharaoh? Is it okay to lie to save lives? Well, to answer the first question, the text doesn't say anywhere that the midwives lied to Pharaoh. For all intent and purposes, it seems that they were actually telling the truth. It seems the midwives, when they said, because the Hebrew women are not like the Egyptian women, that they are indicating maybe a different approach to childbearing. You know, maybe the Egyptian women were used to being pampered. And so they gave birth, you know, however long it took. Maybe it took a really long time for them to give birth. And then as soon as the baby comes out, they you know, because giving birth is exhausting, they just lean back and they are like recovering. And they let the midwives take care of the children. But maybe the Hebrew midwives or wives giving birth, maybe they're more involved. Maybe they want the baby out quicker. And then as soon as the baby comes out, maybe they want to hold and cherish their child. And maybe we can assume these things because if you're a Hebrew, you love life. You treasure life. That's not to say that the Egyptians hated their children and hated all of life, but it is to say a Christian has a high value of life. You know, maybe none of that's true. Maybe, you know, there's no real explanation to why that they would give this, you know, that women are more vigorous. We could think through, maybe these midwives went through out all the Israelites and said, hey, just so you know, Pharaoh gave us a command to kill your child. You better give birth quickly. Or maybe they said, hey, we're commanded to kill your child. Can you please not call us until maybe the baby's like halfway out or out all the way? You know, because Pharaoh's trying to do this, you know, sneakily. He doesn't want everyone to know that he's trying to kill their babies. I mean, it's obvious, but he also is trying not to be that obvious. Either way, though, these women feared the Lord, and because of their fear of the Lord, they preserved lives. But to answer my second question, is it okay to lie to save lives? I think the best way to answer that is to ask the question, who are you obeying? To obey Pharaoh in this account would be to disobey God. Thus, the better question to ask is, where does your loyalty lie? With God or with Pharaoh? Though Pharaoh sees their actions as unrighteous, God sees them as righteous. Thus, when you're living life and you're challenged to make a stand for the gospel, do it, even if it causes you your life. I don't know if you guys are familiar with the Harry Potter series, but in the third book, there's an account where Peter Pettigrew is unveiled by Sirius Black. And he's asked by Black why he didn't protect Lily and James Potter. And Pettigrew responds by saying this. He, referring to Voldemort, he would have killed me. And Black says, then you should have died like your friends before you. That is powerful. Black is stating that life, your life, is nothing compared to the life of those around you. Give it up if it means to save many. What did Christ do for us? He didn't think of himself as too highly, but offered himself as a living sacrifice on our behalf and died. He became a man and died on our behalf. That is awesome. And he didn't just remain in the grave. He rose again on the third day. And he didn't just raise and stay and do nothing. He ascended into heaven where he sits at the right hand of God the Father Almighty and makes intercession on our behalf daily. Let's be bold. Let's put our faith in Jesus Christ alone. Even if the seed of the serpent comes at you on all sides, stand firm. Ask yourself, how will I respond when hard things come into my life? Ask yourself, do you long to live in a community that God gave to his people? Do you long to live in relationship with God on his terms or on your own terms? The cost can be great, But the cost is worth it because Christ has gone out before us, enabling us to live in the promises of God. So be bold. Another application, though, think about this, is that God loves life. Not just children, not just young adults, not just elderly, everybody. The seed of the serpent has many crafty ways of trying to thwart God's plans. But the one that he uses over and over again is the death of children. Look at, if you peek your eyes forward to Exodus chapter 2, you'll see the birth of Israel's Savior, Moses. And then if you have your biblical lenses on, your glasses on, you'll know what happens when Jesus is born. Another king is ruling, and he gives out the very same decree, kill all of the baby boys. The murder of babies, no matter the excuse, is wicked because it aligns itself with the seed of the serpent and not with Jesus Christ. Therefore, live in light of the gospel. Your children are blessings, never curses, never burdens, always joys, and always reflecting the image of God. Satan knows it is through babies that Jesus would come. And Jesus has come. And so Satan wants to kill lives because he hates lives. So this passage, we've seen that the people of God are flourishing because by faith they're living out their biblical mandate. Then we see that when you live in faith, Satan uses people and means to try to snuff you out. But God cannot be snuffed out. And then we saw at the end, the seed of the serpent attacking again by casting all of the children into the Nile. But these baby boys continue to live. So this chapter is merely the beginning of a humongous picture of how God interacts with his people. Moses is birthed in secret like Jesus is birthed in secret. Moses is birthed when a decree comes out to kill all the babies. Jesus is birthed when a decree comes out to kill all the babies. Moses goes into the wilderness. Jesus went into the wilderness. Moses was delivered from death to give us the law of God. Jesus was delivered from death to bring about the law of God written, not on tablets, but on our hearts. Moses delivered the people from out of Egypt into the promised land, but died before the promised land. Jesus delivered his people from death to life through his death and his resurrection. He is the true and greater Moses. Exodus points us to Jesus. Moses points us to Jesus. Let's rejoice that Jesus has done it all for us. And that we do not have to live a perfect life because we can. Christ has done that for us. Let's pray.